Welcome for America as well, and good rule.
I'm on Weimar culture in that last week, and talking about Weimar culture meant by definition, talking about the culture of the intellectual. For as I have said before, and quite often, popular culture did not change much from the 19th century. Neither popular culture nor popular taste. If you see the pictures on your walls, which your landlady puts on her walls, they will be 19th century romantic pictures. If you see what your landlady reads, it will be the same thing her grandmother read in the 19th century. So that's what is really important about Weimar culture. It's the culture of the intellectuals. And the problems concerned with that culture, which are on the one hand problems of culture and rationality, which we talked about, and then the acceptance of the irrational, which I talked about last time, the emergence, the strong emergence of meta-history, though of course you have it with Wagner and others already at the end of the 19th century. And today I must come really to a third aspect, which is the aspect of what we might call a disengagement, and at the same time the restoration of the individual. And that aspect of disengagement and the restoration of the individual is the aspect of the Christian revival after the First World War. Now, after the Second World War, there will be no Christian revival. There will be, however, a great Christian revival after the First World War. And it will be centered again in Germany, as far as Protestantism was concerned. But a very similar revival takes place in Catholicism, and that revival is centered in France. So that you have a general Christian revival, and this general Christian revival is really based on three factors, or the renewal of three factors. One is disengagement. State doesn't matter, the individual matters. And all that really matters in the end is the individual's relation to God. And at the same time, the Bible is taken out of its historical context. Not only is the state denied, history is denied. And in German Protestantism, that was only logical, because the Protestant Church had been so tied up with the Church. It had blessed the battalions in the war. And those who wanted to revive Protestantism after the war, therefore, wanted to disconnect it from the state. Disconnect it from the state. And therefore, centered it upon the individual and the individual's relation to God. Christ and the Bible become no longer something in history, but a symbolic document of man's dialogue with God. The individual is one at the same time, if you like, detached from the state and attached to God. So that you are detached and attached. At the same time, there is a new emphasis on suffering, especially in Catholicism. But in Catholicism, there is the same emphasis on the individual. But uneasily, because in Catholicism, with its hierarchies, it is not possible to deny history. Catholicism and history are so intertwined that you can't really deny it. And still, in France, Jacques Maritain believed, as you know from reading the culture of Western Europe, Jacques Maritain believed also in the dignity of the individual, in the dialogue of the individual with God, but through the church hierarchy. In Protestantism, it was direct. But at the same time, the idea of suffering, that the life of a Christian is suffering, the Christ that now comes of interest in Catholicism, especially in France, is the miracle of La Salette, that is the suffering Christ, the crying Christ, a kind of reflection of the suffering of man after the war. The war, the horror of the war, led in the end to a reaction of the acceptance of suffering. All this can be subsumed, of course, under one headline, the headline of existentialism. Both Protestant and Catholicism became or wanted to become an existential Christianity. And what we mean by an existential Christianity is a Christianity that is directly concerned with man's, with the individual's existential dilemma. Now that is, of course, a general feature, as you know, a general feature. But with Sartre and others, it led to despair. The existential, in secular terms, for Sartre and others, especially in France, with its great pessimism. In France, existentialism led to resignation. And here, if you look at the culture of Western Europe, you will read about Sartre's short story, The Wall. A resignation. You get shot at the wall. You just shrug. That's life. And that fits in with the general pessimism of France. Face of the German advance, in face of the German renewal. The idea we would rather have the Germans in France than fight, the general French resignation in face of the German renewal. Existentialism, however, on a Christian plane, was destined to last much longer, because it is not a resignation. If you like, it turns suffering into a dialogue with God. It turns suffering into a dialogue. A dialogue which is outside history and outside reality. Karl Barth, the refounder of modern Protestantism, in his chief work, The Letters About the Epistles of St. Paul of 1921, directly after the war, 1921, Karl Barth in the Epistles of St. Paul, which are the basic document of what we call neo-orthodoxy, or the refounding, really, of Protestantism, or neo-orthodoxy, Paul said the problem of Christianity is a problem of communication. Communication not with the world, not with the crowd, but by the individual and eternal truth. He rejects the idea of community, of the neighbor, in favor of confrontation. This is not original. Really, it goes back to a man who had been completely forgotten, but who was only now rediscovered, only now, thanks to Karl Barth and others. Kierkegaard, who lived in the mid-19th century, and who was really forgotten. Kierkegaard, this very troubled Danish Lutheran who believed in confrontation, who believed in complete obedience in God, who symbolized the existential dilemma through Abraham's sacrifice to Isaac, that the complete suffering and obedience to God, this immediate confrontation and subjugation to God's will lead to the breakthrough and to a real confrontation, just as Abraham was willing to sacrifice his only son on God's command. It's really a revival of Kierkegaard, who had really been totally forgotten, and that what you have is a confrontation of the individual and God. A confrontation which means suffering, like Abraham suffered when he sacrificed Isaac, but it is suffering which leads to the breakthrough of dialogue. You must first have suffering, then you have dialogue. And this goes back to two things, obviously. It goes back to Christ's suffering before his death, that you must have the passion before you have revelation. You must have Christ's suffering and the breakdown before you have Christ's saving and revelation. And, of course, it is connected to reality. The suffering of revolution and counter-revolution and anxiety, which others wanted to get rid of, as we have discussed before, here are accepted. You must suffer as Christ suffered for the breakdown, as Abraham suffered, for the breakdown of Judaism. Therefore, Barth rejects intellectualism and concentrates on absolute. The confrontation between lonely man and Christ means decision. Man has to take a decision, but the decision is a decision of submission. It is Abraham's decision. It is a decision to submission, a decision of acceptance and submission, which in the end leads to the dialogue. Now this is Lutheranism, for underlying it is one of Luther's chief insights, that you must trust God, that all Christianity depends on trust. You must trust God. And your submission is not an object submission, but it is a submission based on trust. That was Luther's, everything in Lutheranism springs from that. That was actually Luther's basic realization. The decision is therefore a decision for trust. What it means is that science, liberalism, socialism, the nation, are irrelevant. The world is again here becoming highly personalized, and all this is irrelevant. The problem in this is clear. The problem in this, I think, is quite clear. It is first of all an attempt to renew Protestantism by the separation of church and state. After all, it is a truism that religion is corrupted if it is a state religion. This is a truism general. It's corrupted, it becomes political, it isn't really a faith at all anymore. It is a political thing, as you can see in Israel today, perhaps clearer, that if you have church and state together, religion becomes thoroughly corrupted and despicable, and that only in its separation does religion have a chance to individualize itself and to have something to say of the individual confrontation of God without imperialism attached. So what you have, therefore, is here a religion, because the Protestant church in Germany had been a state church, and it had lost out. It had lost out, as state churches eventually do, the English state church included. But the danger in it was equally great. So, for example, in 1933, Karl Barth came to Germany about a month before Hitler took over. Hitler was already on the door and gave a famous lecture on the Reformation, in which he said, in Lutheran way, that faith and the state have nothing to do with each other. And that was just before Hitler. Obviously, Barth changed, and he changed fairly drastically. After all, he became the leader of Protestant resistance to National Socialism. And in 1934, he broke with this side of his neo-orthodoxy in a famous declaration called after the place where it was made, the Bauman Declaration of 1934, written by Karl Barth, subscribed to by at least half of the German Protestant Church, which said this, that the Church must fight the state if the state encroaches upon the Church. And racism is obviously an encroachment, because racism defeats baptism. Racism makes baptism invalid. So that obviously the Nazi church has to be fought. I mean, the Nazi state has to be fought. It is a racist state. We cannot remain neutral, because the state is in fact nullifies the church, or to put it technically, Christ's revelation. So that you have here the beginning of what would be called under the Nazis the confessional church, the Protestant church of the resistance, many of you have heard about already, and the confessional church, which fought National Socialism and especially racism because of its defeat of Christ's function of revelation. which is, after all, the center of Christianity, and especially the center of Neo-Orthodoxy. And yet, apart from that, there is no doubt that Karl Barth and his followers believe that what is the crux of Christianity is not history. The historical Bible is denied. This whole idea of the new biblical scholarship, and with it, liberal Protestantism. Liberal Protestantism, which is historic, which grasps Christ as a historical figure, divine but historical. Liberal Protestantism is rejected as having been so vague a theology that it became anti-Semitic and racist, and indeed followed the state slavishly, because it became too historical and too little theological. A very true and proper criticism. That is what happened with liberal Protestantism. You must not forget something about the history of religion, that whenever religion loses theology, something else has to move in, and what moves in is the state. It then comes to follow the fashion of the state. That's, of course, what's happened to American Protestantism, where in the American churches you preach today, be good to blacks, women's liberation, and all these things which have only a very indirect relation to theology. But once you give up any theological mooring, obviously the door is open to everything. And so liberal Protestantism was quite open to the fashion of National Socialism. Once you become trendy as a church, then all trends can have an entry. And Karl Barth, of course, realized this very well, and his followers in America, these first, realized this extremely well. Therefore, together with this, there is a definite existential theology. Existential theology, namely, that you must fight the state if the state encroaches on Christian salvation. But otherwise, Christianity means a decision on your part, a decision to submission, a decision of trust. And this decision of submission is bolstered by the Bible which is taken as a symbolic document, symbolic of man's dialogue with God, man's obedience to God, but man's dialogue with God. But this submission, this suffering, leads to a personal dialogue to God, the I and thou, which Martin Buber had as well, but Martin Buber had it in a more general and murky way than Karl Barth, because Buber had no revelation to base it on. So it's a murky thing with Buber, but most things with Buber I'm afraid are. But quite apart from that, it's the same kind of thing. A personalization, an I and thou relationship. But not as in Buber, one that comes straight away, but one that comes only after a personal, existential decision. These ideas were further elaborated by the second most important man in the Protestant revival, Paul Tillich. Especially important in America, for a while, of course, Barth never came over here, really. Paul Tillich became a leading professor at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and Paul Tillich trained a whole generation of American Protestants, and indeed it would be quite right to say he gave American Protestantism, which it never had, a theology, a commitment. I remember very well, many years ago, Paul Tillich talked here in Great Hall to a huge audience, and the professor of philosophy, now dead, who was presiding over him, asked Paul Tillich a typical American question. Don't you think really that any religion is as good as another? And Paul Tillich said, if I didn't believe Christianity was the truth, I wouldn't be a Christian theologian. So that is the most un-American statement. But of course, Tillich's whole speech here was against the so-called American community church, which is, of course, neither fish nor flesh. It's nothing. So, what you have, therefore, here, then, is this kind of commitment that you have with Paul Tillich and Barth, and which injected into American Protestantism a totally new and tremendously influential stream. Tillich broadens this into a much more broader existentialist theology. For Tillich is above all concerned being of a younger generation and being growing up, as it were, into the Nazi period, where Barth was already an old man. Tillich, growing up into the Nazi period, was above all concerned with the phenomena of alienation. And here he was much influenced by socialism. Here he was much influenced in the way of the left, something that Barth never was. Tillich was a German. Barth lived most of his life in the Swiss city of Basel. Well, if there's anything more bourgeois than the Swiss city of Basel, I haven't found it. Basel is incredible. Incredible. It has its own bourgeois heritage, its own bourgeois hierarchy. If you are a Vogel with F, you're on top. If you're a Vogel with V, you're nowhere. I remember my sister studied there, and she was on the radio. She had to take a special course in Swiss German. Basel is an incredible. The only good thing is it has muesli, my favorite food. But otherwise, it isn't worth it. So, Barth had no idea of socialism. How should he really? Nothing really of this nature intruded into his little island there in Switzerland. But Tillich is different. Tillich grew up in Germany when the Nazis came to power. And so, his idea is really alienation. And in a sense, he integrates alienation into this existential. It goes somewhat like this. What we have today, says Tillich, is unbelief, self-elevation, the will to power. He looked to the Nazis and he said, look, the will to power has run riot. This is Nietzsche, run riot. The will to power has run riot. No, self-elevation, man as God. And indeed, he criticizes Sigmund Freud in this regard. The libido is not necessarily the pleasure principle. But indeed, what man can be something for his own sake. Man can love for his own sake. Man exists for his own sake. Man does not have to reach for power. Man does not have to reach for pleasure. Sigmund Freud was wrong. The libido is not necessarily the pleasure principle, which involves others, which again means reaching out and has within it, he thought, the seed of a domination. What is sin? Sin must be redefined. Sin is the will to power. Sin is the pleasure principle. Sin is the self-elevation. And what is the punishment for sin? How are you punished? You are punished through anxiety. So in other words, Tillich puts this whole matter of sin and punishment onto a contemporary scene, onto a modern scene, alienation from yourself by the will to power, by the quest for pleasure. On the one hand, that is the sin. The sin is being alienated from yourself. It's very Hegelian and therefore somewhat Lutheran, but I can't go into this now. You are alienated from yourself on the one hand, and you are punished for that alienation by anxiety. By anxiety. For what do? You deny your potential. Man, and here he cites Kierkegaard, merely becomes a part of nature. Man is merely a part of empirical nature. If man is alienated from himself, and the self-alienation is the will to power, he looked at National Socialism, of course, as the main evidence of self-alienation. Imperialism as the main evidence of self, alienation, any kind of domination of man over man is a sign of anxiety. It's a sign that you are not just. Now this is very Marxist, very Marxist indeed, because what Tillich really says is that Christianity is the way to appropriate what is yours. And that is what Marx says. What we have to do is to appropriate what is ours. It's what Hegel says, in fact. We must appropriate what is ours. We must get rid of the division of labor in Marx. But with Tillich in the 1930s, it is domination. And we must again appropriate what is ours. If we appropriate what is ours, what does that mean? And here he comes back again. Christ is the example of the true existential man. That is what Christ is all about. He is an example of the true existential man, of one who overcame his alienation, who overcame sinning, if you like, the true man, Christ, man. Why? Here I come back again to God, in a sense, because Christ subjected himself to the misery of existence, to suffering, Christ's passion. Christ's passion, really, in modern times, is our anxiety. Christ's passion stands for the anxiety of modern man. And to overcome this anxiety, this alienation from himself, Christ submits himself to God. He submits himself to God unquestionably. He takes the decision of complete submission and unity. And that means he takes it upon himself to be lonely. He knows what is loneliness, and he rejoices in his loneliness. Here you have what I call the withdrawal. Man must appropriate what is his. And that means to know how to be lonely. With Tillich, the theory of the system, if you like, for God, is at one and the same time a decision of submission, a decision of overcoming, and a decision of loneliness. Of loneliness. And that starts the dialogue with God, which will overcome your anxiety, which will overcome your alienation. You will overcome it in your dialogue in God if you know what it is to be lonely. There is therefore here confrontation. There is here confrontation with man's situation, if you like, which is very clear. Man is himself a world. As self, he is an individual person who participates universally. He is a dynamic, self-transcending agent. In other words, man needs no one outside himself. Man is a self-contained agent. And if he needs somebody outside himself, that is his sin. He has thrown away what God made him. God made him lonely and self-contained and gave him the possibility for a dialogue with God. But instead, man had sinned through reaching out for power and domination, for reaching out for pleasure, for joining and going in groups. And instead, you have this individualism restored. It goes without saying that the experience of the dialogue with God is a personal experience. The symbol of a personal God, says Tillich, is absolutely fundamental, because an existential relation is a person-to-person relation. Man cannot be ultimately concerned about anything that is less than personal. But since personality includes individuality, the question arises, is God then an individual? And the answer is that man individualizes God. He treats him like an individual and yet transcendent partner. And he is able to do so because of the intermediacy of Christ. The intermediacy of Christ. What is involved here is, of course, a reinterpretation of Christ's saving of revelation. Christ saves through making possible a dialogue with God. Christ saves through making possible your individuality. Christ saves, if you like, through making possible loneliness, through making possible this kind of loneliness. And the fall is the fall from individuality, the fall, if you like, from loneliness itself. That is a difficult. What then is the fall, Adam and Eve? It is man falls into the state of estrangement. And with him, from himself, and with him his world also falls. Understood in this way, the myth of the fall, for which there are analogies in most religions, represent a very particular case of the transition from innocence to the tragic guilt, the tragic guilt of alienation. So, what we call all this, and this is another idea or phrase that you should know in a sense, we call all this the symbolic uses of the Bible, because this is a reinterpretation from the literal, if you like, to the symbolic of this nature. It is clear also that this was a theology for disturbed times. But on the Catholic side, where you have much the same, let me point out, you have much the same with Jacques Maritain above all. This is, of course, the individualism cannot be that sense. Because the dialogue with God is mediated through the church. It's mediated through the symbols of the church. It's mediated through the hierarchy of the church. Nevertheless, in both the Catholic Renaissance, in Maritain and in Bernanos, the individual dignity of man comes to stand again in a way, in the forefront. Here also, in a way, there is a decision to submission. Here also, there is a rejection of the outward world, a rejection of rank, of richness, of which means nothing. The idea of charity, so important in the Catholic Renaissance, whenever it takes place, the idea of charity. The task of the church, says Bernanos, is to reveal the source of a joy loss. And the joy loss is an internalized approach. The joy loss is the joy of your own wholeness, of your own appropriation of what belongs to you, your own appropriation. And the difference is perhaps typical, that in this appropriation in Catholicism, there is a greater stress of reason and lesser stress on trust. You submit because your reason tells you to submit. And you use the facilities of the Catholic Church to come to a dialogue because they are rational. They correspond to reason. They are rational. The priest, the father confessor, the same. These are rational ideas which help you climb the ladder to recapture yourself in all your fullness, in all your fullness. And typically enough, this is uneasy. Bernanos' most famous writing is what he calls the Confessions of a Vicar of Savoy, which is a direct reference to Rousseau, by the way, in which Confessions of the Vicar of Savoy, if you want to read one document of the Catholic Renaissance, I suppose that is really the most important one, and the confession of the Vicar of Savoy a reference to Rousseau. That is to say, to recapture your own individuality through the use of faith and reason, to become a whole man, to end your alienation, and to make this kind of decision. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. It's not the Confession of Vicar Savoy is Rousseau. It's called the Confession of a Vicar, a Country Vicar. I'm sorry, in English it's called the Diary of a Country Priest. That's what it's called in Bernard. But it's a direct thing of Rousseau's Vicar Savoy. Written in 1934 to 1936. And here again, the outside world is rejected. Life must be simple, it must be internal, and it must be a life of love. That means a life of charity. And that is why the Catholic Renaissance, unlike the Lutherans, has the strength of socialism. Why in the end Bernanos and all of those come to a kind of alliance with the French left, which Barthes and Tilly never really did. Because in Catholicism, really, the outside world is never so totally repudiated. There's always in Catholicism the idea of charity, which dates from the Catholic Renaissance of the 17th century, Pascal, but which is very strong indeed. And therefore, if you have within it charity, as in Catholicism more than in Protestantism, charity, that is doing good, is part of your own personality. What actually comes out of it is that indeed there is a connection, and the connection is to further whatever opposes riches, whatever opposes rank, whatever makes for equality, and therefore you have involved here a kind of charity, Christian love, and simplicity. But in the last resort, of course, what counts is the dignity of the individual. The dignity of the individual. So to summarize, in this kind of Christianity, you have an existential Christianity, different than what we've talked about, different than culture and rationalism, different than irrationalism. Because it has nothing to do with a collectivity. It rejects the nation. It rejects nationalism. And instead, an attempt to restore, if you like, the wholeness of the individual on the grounds of Christianity. And with Martin Buber, there is a similar attempt for Jews on the grounds of Judaism. A very similar, perhaps, a more difficult attempt, or not in Buber's part, of the same kind of thing. So that this is, in a sense, an attempt of all religious intellectuals. Martin Buber, Paul Tillich, Maritain, and Barnano. But it is a matter of intellectuals. Well, I must come back again here that the gap between popular religion and popular culture could not be greater. Popular religion never, of course, ceases. The Diary of a Country Priest is not a country priest. A Catholic country priest in France still preaches what they always preach. That is to say, obedience, submission, the importance of the church, and nothing at all about the dialogue. You can try it out wherever I am. I go to country churches on Sunday. And the sermons are always the same. Obey, don't doubt, don't use your conscience. Vatican II makes no impact on that, of course, at all. Don't use your conscience, and the saints are always regarded as objects of worship instead of symbols. Obviously. In popular culture in Protestant countries, it's just the same. It's just the same. It is a matter of faith, of belief, of what intellectuals would call superstition. So then here too you go ahead. And I would say the influence of the Catholic Renaissance and the Protestant Renaissance has been diverse. And yet it has been out of proportion. Because the influence of the Catholic Protestant Renaissance was not great in Europe, but in America. Europe, it hasn't had such a great impact, but in America, because American Protestantism had no theology, and it had to find one, and it found one in Union Theological Seminary and in Paul Tillich, through Reinhold Niebuhr and others who became convinced of it. And as such, I think it still is very important, because that is the Protestantism that is taught in most Protestant seminaries. The Catholic Renaissance had an influence too, above all on Pope John the 23rd, not on Pope VI. Pope VI came from a backward region, and not of the present Pope, who comes from another backward region of Catholicism. So as long as the Pope came from the most backward regions of the Church, this would have no influence at all. But the one Pope who came, not from the backward regions of the Church, but indeed from a pretty advanced part of the world, it had an influence. So it has an influence on Catholicism, on the papacy, but an influence that is less and less as the more easier practice of reaction comes to dominate, or rather of a tradition, of tradition comes to dominate. And therefore, oddly enough, the Catholic Renaissance has had more influence on French intellectual life as such than on the Church. Indeed, I would say it is about the only exciting thing that happened in French intellectual life in the 1930s, the Catholic Renaissance. And it was, if you like, the contribution of France to the general intellectual ferment. It's difficult to find much else. As I have told you already, France was becoming, in this way, a backwater itself. Mr. Weishaupt, now I can hear your question.
I was just curious, to what extent the externalized the
What do you mean external?
Yes,
that's right. But they externalized it with the Nazis. I mean, the Bauman Declaration, their anti-Nazi stand, don't forget. In other words, it becomes externalized if the state prevents you in the end from becoming that kind of individual, yes? Which a racist state would do. You see what I mean? So they became the spearhead of the Christian resistance against National Socialism, yes? And to a certain extent, the French Catholic Renaissance became that resistance. Maritain fled to America from occupied France, and so on. In other words, all these Renaissances became opposed to National Socialism. Above all, as nothing of the like took part in Italy, which in this case, religiously, is a terribly backward region, for many reasons, a very backward region. I can't really tell you what their attitude would have been to non-racist fascism, yes? That I can't tell you. I think it would probably have been an attitude of rather neutrality, but not on the French Catholic Renaissance, which made this idea of charity and love, and which early on made a kind of alliance, if you like, with the left, yes? So while I'm sure that Bernanos and Maritain, in fact they did, condemn Italian fascism, yes? I'm by no means so sure about Tillich and Bach. I once had a conversation with Paul Tillich about that, but it wasn't under the best auspices. We went camping in the Sierra. He and I had never been camping and were never again in my life. Here, as we lay on the ground and were pelted by huge pineapple, what is it called, these things fall off trees. And then a bear came and played with him, and I thought he was a great theologian, prayed. Here I am, it worked, but the next day we went back, and anyhow, we had the donkey along to carry the wine. I'm afraid Tilly couldn't do without that. So, what you have here then, I just don't quite know. I don't quite know how exactly it actually, the attitude towards fascism. But by and large, I would have thought that would have been more in a neutral way, yeah? But certainly not for the Catholic Renaissance, which had a great thing in those things outside, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Now, with this Christian revival, we are then on the threshold of fascism itself. And let me remind you that we now have, said something about Weimar culture, which will last and which will not be cut off by fascism, oddly enough. And then we have said something before about socialism, and especially the socialism which tried to escape from the Marxist cave, the Marxist revival in the Weimar Republic. And that too will last. So that the contribution of these Weimar intellectuals, if you want to call them that, of the Weimar intellectuals, the architects, to a certain extent the literature, of course, the socialists, and the Protestants, Hitler will not be able to defeat, that they will be carried on partly by the refugees who came to America, and partly by another astonishing rediscovery of all of it in the 1960s, especially of the socialism in the 1960s itself. What you have therefore then is that in the last resort, Weimar culture is not confined to its historical period. That it is goes beyond it, into the 1960s and 1970s, and that you can say that the failure to cut it off is one of Hitler's great failures in the realm of culture. That as a matter of fact, very little of Nazi culture survived, but Weimar culture did. And still determined, the Marxist debate determines determines our architecture and determines in the end what is taught in American Protestant seminaries. It becomes to a certain extent institutionalized through education, which as you know is the best way and the most solid way to transmit a cultural ideal, to transmit a culture from one generation to another. With that, we must now come to actual fascism. Fascism, which took over a great deal of what I've talked about, which is very differentiated. And here, in the lectures that I have, I will be more general, because you will read anyway the two little books on fascism, and I will start with that on Wednesday.